Hello. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Ecosystemic Futures Podcast. I'm your host, Diane Finkhausen, founder of Shoshenworks, advising organizations at the intersection of ecosystemic transformation, innovation, and digital industry. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping the fundamental frameworks within society, industry, economy, and policy, and reframing how we innovate and build for the future. In this podcast series, we're exploring these new ecosystemic impacts across every facet of society, from the future of education, work, agriculture, engineering, tech, aviation, and space, to name just a few. Today, we'll be discussing the ethical considerations of AI and how to navigate the technology and use within ecosystemic frameworks. My co-host today is James Villarubia from NASA. Welcome, James.
Hello, everyone. My name is James Villarubia. I'm a White House Presidential Innovation Fellow with NASA. I'm also a former CEO and CTO in the social impact startup sectors, and everything from cryptography and healthcare to education and AI. And I'm a former statistician and senior policy advisor for the White House, DOD, and DOJ. And I think a lot of the organizations I've managed in the social impact and public sectors have had ethical risks and trade-offs at the heart of their work. So I'm really excited, Diane, to dig into this topic today. And joining us today is Reid Blackman, founder and CEO of Virtue, an AI ethical risk consultancy. Welcome, Reid.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Reid, why don't you give us a brief introduction to Virtue and sort of the work that you do there?
Yeah, sure. So I started Virtue about 5 years ago. The main thing that we do is advise government and large enterprise on how to identify and mitigate the ethical risk associated with various digital technologies. Obviously, there's a particular emphasis on AI right now, since that's where a lot of the action is. But we also work on blockchain, AR, VR, quantum computing, etc.
Amazing. It's really excited to have you with us, Reid. This is such a timely and absolutely critical topic and domain. And I think our listeners are going to really enjoy your perspective, your work, and your worldview here. So, Reid, you advise some of the most important organizations around the world about how they should be thinking about risks associated with not only AI, but a lot of emerging technologies, and particularly as it relates to the ethics embedded in the deployment and the utility of these technologies, which were obviously excited to dive into today, as we also have been studying basically largely tech-enabled shift to more connected societies and industries, and how we should be thinking about designing for ecosystemic wellness. So your work and worldview are at the very heart of what we think needs to be addressed for ecosystemic wellness. To set the stage for the conversation here today and for our audience, can you maybe just walk us through some of the frameworks for the risks that we're trying to avoid?
Yeah, sure. I mean, when you say framework, do you mean something like, how do we think about sort of chopping up the categories of ethical risk? Is that the idea?
Yeah, exactly right.
I mean, there are different ways to do this. Before I talk about my own way of doing it, if you look at the healthcare industry, which has been talking the language of ethics and doing ethical risk mitigation for a long time now, for several decades, then you see them working with three main ethical principles: respect for persons, justice, and the principle of beneficence or non-maleficence. Do good, don't do harm. So that's the way, that's there, if you like. That's the medical ethics framework, which one could use in the tech space as well, if you wanted to. I use a slightly more fine-grained set of categories. So mine includes physical well-being or physical harms, mental or emotional harms, also respect for persons, justice and social responsibility, relationships and social cohesion, that sort of thing. I mean, I could go on with the categories, but look, the crucial thing here is not what are the particular categories that my team and I use, but it's that what, and different companies use different categories. What's important is that the categories, the set of categories represents the set of all possible ethical risks. You want those categories, that framework, to be exhaustive, otherwise things fall through the cracks. So for instance, if the way that you cut things up doesn't allow for an identification of, say, issues pertaining to widening wealth inequality, that's potentially a problem if that should be on your radar. So it's about the comprehensiveness of the categories as opposed to which way you happen to slice it up.
Interesting. So, I mean, I guess there's a lot of nuance in sort of the way that people talk about these ethical categories. But I guess I want to sort of think about sort of the the nature of these categories as how they sort of impact the sort of the current space of investigation. We see a lot of companies today talking about sort of digital transformation, new technologies. These new technologies seem to maybe push the boundaries of some categories, or at least push us into some new conversations we haven't seen before. Can you talk about maybe sort of what you're seeing in this sort of digital transformation space, or what are the emerging technologies that are really sort of challenging the ethics community?
Well, look, I mean, I don't think that we're seeing, maybe I might back off this claim, but I'll say it at least initially as we explore it. The issue is not so much that there are new ethical risks, that there are new sources of ethical risks. So discrimination against based on race, ethnicity, gender, et cetera, that's existed forever. AI didn't invent it, but its particular problem with AI or machine learning in particular, because the way that machine learning works highly increases the probability that you're going to wind up with a biased or discriminatory model, an ethically biased or discriminatory model. So it's that the way that ML works creates a new source of a very familiar ethical risk. And that's a lot of these things going on. So you could also talk about privacy violations as a result of all the data collection. But of course, discussions about privacy have existed also forever. So again, we're not getting a new ethical risk. We have the old familiar ethical risk of violating people's privacy, but now we've got new and exciting ways to do that. So it's more about identifying those new sources so that we can identify the appropriate risk mitigation strategies and tactics given those new sources, not about, oh my God, these are completely new problems that we've never thought about.
Do you think these new sources that are any more nuanced or difficult to understand than maybe some prior considerations, or is it every generation thinks that their new stuff is the hardest and newest and most difficult things to understand?
Yeah, probably the latter. A lot of the questions that face us are familiar questions to ethicists and to philosophers more generally. So, for instance, ethics slightly to the side, or let's take something that's ethics adjacent, but talk about whether ChatGPT is a piece of artificial general intelligence. Well, does it understand, if you like, what it's saying? When it outputs some text, does it understand what it's saying? If you want to answer that question, you're going to have some grip on what constitutes linguistic or semantic understanding in the first place. But that's just a question that philosophers and linguists, for that matter, have been working on for many, many, many years, decades, centuries, etc. I mean, are we going to get right. So what's the connection between, for instance, semantic understanding and consciousness? Is there a connection that we need? Do we need consciousness in order to get understanding? Again, age-old philosophical questions repackaged in the garb of technology. That's not to say that the questions are not really important. It's just that it's not completely new ground.
Fascinating. So really what we're facing, to your point, are new sources and new velocity, right? So the speed at which these new sources are coming at us, if you will, is perhaps a bit increased over kind of the past sources that we might have based in previous decades. So if we think about that.
And sorry, I'll say one thing. They're also being raised by the different people. They're being faced by people that didn't face them before. So right. I'll just give you one more example. If we're talking about, say, bias in machine learning, the ethical bias in machine learning, well, who's the first, if you like, line of defense against that? Data scientists. Well, that's weird. That people from, if you like, the math side of things are not standardly educated on and experienced with assessing whether some scenario is one in which there is ethical discrimination involved. That's not their thing. But of course, various kinds of analyses of what constitutes discrimination, what constitutes justifiable differential treatment, that kind of discussion has been going on for decades, centuries, right? So it's not merely that it's, if you like, a new generation, as James pointed out, it's just a new, you know, it's new people to the space by virtue of the kind of work that they're doing. So now data scientists have to ask questions like, okay, how do we assess whether the distribution of goods here, a mortgage or some other kind of loan or insurance or healthcare or access to getting interviewed for a job or getting into a university, they've now got to ask these questions about whether their model is distributing the good in a fair and just way. And they don't have, standardly, they do not have the skill or experience or knowledge to make those kinds of judgments. What you get are quantitative ways of measuring for fairness that the computer science literature has discovered or created. And then you have, once again, data scientists asking, what's the ethically appropriate quantitative metric to use for fairness? How do we measure fairness in this particular case? philosophers, ethicists in particular, civil rights attorneys, civil rights specialists for that matter, have asked and thought about those questions for a very long time. It's just new to data scientists.
Yeah, great point. So we have new sources, new stewards, new speed, which suggests that we need to make sure we're going back upstream, right? And making sure that we have the right protocols and the right skills in order to design for not bad, right? Design for good.
And that's right.
Yeah.
One thing, there's sort of two approaches. One, which I think people are getting a little bit quieter about, thankfully. One was, we need to train the data scientists how to do ethics well. That's sort of still in the air as a thing. And I think that's sort of silly. I could no more teach them to be an ethicist in a workshop than they could teach me to be a data scientist in a quick workshop. That's not going to happen. What's important is that data scientists and other technologists come to appreciate and understand the kinds of contributions that need to be made by other kinds of experts, like ethicists, as an example.
Yeah.
So, I want to follow up on that a little bit. I mean, if I had to sort of think about sort of the big technology shifts in the last century, I can think of sort of projects like the Manhattan Project, large government-run projects, large government in investments based out of national labs. It sounds like, I mean, my perspective would be that a lot of those sort of harder ethical conversations were happening inside government, because government was the sort of sole source for a long time of the biggest investments, the capital investment required for big tech. Now that has shifted to the private sector, where we've got sort of competition between the biggest AI, various large tech companies now, and maybe those companies aren't as set up to sort of stop or go as slowly or consider the ethical considerations as maybe sort of government was in sort of the prior decades. Is that fair, or is that part of the speed issue that we're facing?
I mean, there's an empirical question here about whether those largest projects really were, in fact, funded more by government, not by private corporations, et cetera, et cetera. I'm sure there were large technological innovations made by private companies that raised various kinds of ethical questions. I don't know, think about Ford Motor Companies or something along those lines. That said, I think you are right that at a minimum, government did, in fact, fund these things, these kinds of large projects. And the function of government, right? We could debate about what's within the purview of government and what's not all day, what counts as government overreach and what does not. But at a bare minimum, if you think that there ought to be a government, I would think that you think its function is at a minimum to protect people from the worst that could happen to them, roughly, something along those lines. So if that's right, then if the government is funding or engaged in these large-scale, highly impactful projects, then part and parcel of their responsibility, and they know this, is to safeguard citizens. Right? That's it's just built into what their mission is as a government, their function, their purpose. We don't have that, of course, with private corporations. For the most part, private corporations conceive of themselves as having one and only one obligation, which is to maximize shareholder value. And so you don't get responsibility or a sense of responsibility to the general citizenry built in. You just get a concern for maximizing profits. And so as a result, unsurprisingly, you get unscrupulous behavior resulting in harm to tens of thousands, millions of people.
So if we think about that, Reid, in your book, Ethical Machines, in our recent talks, you have encouraged us to think about establishing frameworks to design for good and design for not bad, i.e. do no harm, right? So you spend a lot of time thinking about the ecosystemic reach and impact of many of these technologies and working with both the organizations that provide them and that consume them. What are some of the ethical nightmares that you think are more likely to occur? And what are some of the great examples of how companies have designed to mitigate against that?
Right. So one, you're bringing out something that I try to hammer home every time. There's a difference between AI for good or tech for good and AI or tech for not bad. The tech for good folks want to create positive social impact. That's their mission, if you like. They're not bad people, and that's me, are people who think, all right, look, you're going to do what you're going to do for business purposes. Just make sure that in doing it, you don't create, you don't ethically wrong people. That's what we want to avoid. So it's not about positive social impact. It's about avoiding wronging people as being the number one priority. And I think that's true both from an ethics perspective and a business perspective. I think ethically speaking, first, do no harm. And business-wise, don't do harm to your brand and the people that you serve. So I think the businesses should be focused on AI or tech for not bad. To put it slightly differently, I think they should be focused on ethical risk mitigation as opposed to creating positive social impact. You want to create positive social impact? That's wonderful. Go do it. But it's got to be secondary to, of course, not making an ethical mess of things. So then what I tell people to focus on, as you mentioned, Diane, is tell me what your ethical nightmares are. I want, really, companies should do two things. Number one, tell us what your ethical nightmares are. And number two, tell us what you're putting in place to avoid those ethical nightmares. I mean, if every company did those two seriously, we would avoid a tremendous amount of damage to people and society as a whole. So I think that's what needs to be done. Now, as for companies that do this really well, it's not really clear. If you had asked me this a couple of months ago, I would have said Microsoft was at the cutting edge here. They've run into some issues lately. I wrote an op-ed actually for the New York Times that I think that they've compromised on their principles in an effort to beat Google in the chatbot, ChatGPT, large language model search race. So there are companies out there that are doing decently. My clients, obviously, I think are doing a decent job, but no one got it nailed down right, exactly right. And part of that is because it all has to get done voluntarily at this point.
Yeah, you touched upon a couple of the recent headlines that we've had our eye on as well. We've seen some of the big tech organizations either deprioritizing or reorganizing their ethics resources. And there's a lot of speculation in the press about what that means and the long-term implications of that. These companies have massive ecosystems. And so the implications of these decisions could have deep and fairly expansive reach. But what are your thoughts regarding some of these moves and how should their networks be thinking about them?
Yeah, I mean, if you go back just to 2019, Google had an ethics board, an AI ethics board for half a second before they dissolved it because of the controversy surrounding who they put on that board. But if you go if you go more recent than that, in late last year, something like November of 2022, you saw Meta dissolve its responsible innovation team, and you saw Twitter, specifically Elon Musk, dissolving their AI ethics team. And today is March 16th, 2023. I think something like 3 days ago, Microsoft dissolved its ethics and society team, which played a large role, from what I gather, in getting product teams to take into account their responsible AI principles in the development of their AI. So it seems that companies are somehow unable to hold on to their ethics teams, or if not unable, rather, I'd say unwilling. It seems to be low on the priority list. It's a big deal. It's a really big deal. I mean, we were told to some extent that self-regulation is possible here. I never really believed it, but I held out some degree of hope that a decent job could be done. But I think that just given those three, four very recent examples, it's not the case that these companies can do it by themselves. I do think there needs to be regulation around this stuff. Otherwise, it's going to be disaster after disaster. And it does tell when Microsoft says, hey, we don't need an ethics and society team, they are implicitly communicating to anyone they advise or people who follow them, you don't need one either. If Microsoft doesn't need it, then you don't. Now, Microsoft does have still standing an Office of Responsible AI. They have a chief responsible AI officer, but still, it's not clear what kind of power that office has. And in fact, I think there's a massive question mark about how much power they have, given the way that Microsoft rolled out Bing plus ChatGPT.
So if there is sort of a need for some sort of increased regulation or policy, what does that policy actually look like? I mean, how would we balance equity and access with improved outcomes, given that there's a lot of nuance to a lot of these technologies? Technology is imperfect. I guess my concern is that I've seen some organizations be so afraid of failing on sort of an equity consideration that they don't move forward at all.
Yeah.
And then sort of aren't keeping up, which is, we don't want government to sort of optimize for poor outcomes for all. So what would a governance or sort of a policy framework look like to sort of encourage the behavior that you're looking for, Reid?
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, that just sort of speaks to the need. I mean, if you're talking about putting regulations to the side, you do need some kind of AI or digital ethical risk program. I agree with you that there are companies who are justifiably worried about using AI because they don't know how to avoid, or they're not sure whether they can avoid, the ethical risks associated with them, most infamously biased or discriminatory models. But it's a solvable problem. It's a very, very solvable problem. People will say things like, oh, ethics is hard, it's squishy, it's subjective, oh, we've got discrimination, what constitutes discrimination? But it's simply not the case that we have no answers here. I think that there are very clear answers. I know, I mean, my team and I have helped enterprise companies build digital and AI ethical risk programs that systematically identify and mitigate those risks. The problem, frankly, is not that no one knows how to do it well and safely. It's that organizations standardly lack the political will to do it.
Yeah, and great point. And the world's moving fast too, right? So even if you have invested for your organization, you have to look upstream to the technologies and the solutions that you're consuming and integrating to take your solutions to market. So if we think about the propagation of black box scenarios and the decisions that business leaders need to take in order to consume upstream solutions from vendors and integrate those into solutions that they need to take to market and associate with their brand and their client experience, how should business leaders be thinking about until we have a more mature kind of adoption and deployment of ethics resources and frameworks? How should business leaders be solving for transparency, explainability, and basically the fiduciary responsibility that they have when they're taking their solutions to market that perhaps are consuming black box solutions from vendors? How do they solve for that tension?
Yeah, I think it's a really important point that you're making about procurement is a crucial part of the problem. So a lot of people, when you talk to them about AI ethical risks or digital ethical risks, they think only about what's being done in-house. They don't think about the solution that's being sold to their HR team, to their HR unit, which is an AI solution, which might be a black box solution, which might be a bias or discriminatory solution. They don't know. And the HR people don't know the questions to ask. Even if they know the questions to ask, they don't know what the right answers look like. There haven't been internal processes set up to link HR procurement to the people within that organization who are capable of doing the kind of risk assessment that needs to be done. I think right now we have, in many instances, just a bunch of Trojan horse situations. And you take OpenAI and ChatGPT-4 now, you might take that. Lots of companies are now trying to figure out how do we use this stuff, but they don't have the proper program in place to vet it. From a technical perspective, from a cybersecurity perspective, and from an ethical and reputational risk perspective, that sort of stuff just doesn't exist in most companies. So it's crucial that there's a systematic way whereby these kinds of things are vetted, properly vetted, and monitored when they're deployed. That doesn't exist for the most part. The other thing that I want to pick up on that you said is that it's not just about AI. It's about what's coming down the pipeline. So today, you might soon be using AI or ML. You may also be using, or if you're not, you will tomorrow. Your organization might be using AR/VR, or blockchain, or quantum computers. We don't know. I mean, actually, we do know. Those things are here, and they're continuously being developed and brought into the realm of enterprise. And so one thing that we always stress with our clients is, when they say they want an AI ethical risk program, we say, we can do that, but listen, here's what we recommend. Don't think about AI ethical risk program. Think about a digital ethical risk program that is future-proofed against future technologies, whatever's coming down the pipeline. You could have a sort of module that focuses on AI ethical risks, but then you need to have a framework that's flexible enough to accommodate those new technologies coming down the pipeline that maybe your organization doesn't use today, but it is almost definitely going to use it tomorrow. So you need to have that flexibility in your framework. Did I answer your question, Diane?
Yeah, you sure did. So smart. So I love the concept of this digital ethical risk program that is future-proofed, right? You're really, what I'm hearing is that organizations need to amend, if they haven't already, their kind of future scenario planning process to understand kind of that, basically the ethical risk layer that overlays that landscape, and that they have the right sensing and sense-making protocols in place so that they can future-proof and mitigate against risk that may be coming down the pike. If you think about that landscape, Reid, what are the hot spots right now that you envision are the ethical risk hot spots, and based on what you're seeing of the development and deployment of emerging technologies today, are there any areas that you're keeping a particular eye on that could represent shocks in the market to the extent that things go bad?
I mean, obviously, everyone is talking about generative AI now and large language models in particular. So that's the hot thing right now, and for good reason. I mean, there's been a tremendous amount of activity. And so focusing on that, thinking about that is going to be really important now and for the foreseeable future. To me, though, it's the real takeaway that leaders need to think about is the following. They didn't know ChatGPT-3 or ChatGPT-4 was coming like this now and what it can do, right? You rewind 3 months. They weren't ready for this. They didn't know what was coming. They didn't get it. The question then is not what should we do about ChatGPT, or that's one thing. That's one thing to do. But the bigger question that those leaders need to take away when they're thinking about what good future proofing looks like is, okay, we didn't know that was coming. We also don't know what's coming 4 months from now, or 6 months from now, or a year from now. We just don't know. I mean, generative AI wasn't a thing that people went around saying a bunch, or large language models. I mean, people didn't go around saying that a bunch, let's say a year ago. So we don't know what we're going to be saying. What's the kind of AI that we're going to be talking about next year? We don't totally know. But to constantly reinvent the wheel, to play a game of whack-a-mole, is highly inefficient and highly ineffective. And so the question is not, what do you do about this or that, but how do we create a program that when the next thing comes, we're already ready for it because we have a framework and an approach that is flexible enough to accommodate whatever technology is coming down and whatever application of the technology is coming down.
So what do you think then are some of the future scenarios? I mean, putting, say, the ChatGPT sort of current AI iteration aside, what do you think is next? Well, I'm not asking you to predict the future here, but if there were at least three or four concepts out there or concerns out there, nightmare scenarios, as you call them, coming down the pipe that you were most worried about, what would those be?
I don't know that I have any sort of, again, blatantly new ones. I mean, I'm definitely worried about the ease with which one can create and spread disinformation using large language models, using social media. I mean, that's actually a nice example of how converging technologies create big problems. That's the other thing that we haven't talked about yet. And we talk about the ethical risks of AI or blockchain or of quantum or AR, VR. But the other thing is that these things all, there's interoperability here, right? These things, none of them exist in isolation or in a vacuum. They, if you like, play with each other, giving rise to emergent risks. So if you had social media, okay, that's already an issue. If you've got large language models creating that can easily create massive lots of text that's disinformation, okay. But now you introduce that to social media, and now you've got the spread of disinformation at scale. So it's the conversions of social media with large language models as they exist today that creates a massive ethical risk of the spread of disinformation, undermining democracy, undermining the possibility of an informed citizenry, et cetera, et cetera. And then you think about other things that are going to get combined. So one thing that I think a lot about is the intersection of quantum computing and AI. Quantum computing it's chugging away. I mean, those researchers at places like IBM and Google are really making impressive developments within the field of quantum computers. And while we don't have to go into the details of them at the moment, at least we could. The short of it is that quantum computers utilize a phenomenal amount of data. They can process tremendous amounts of data. And now you marry that with AI, and what do you have? The blackest of black models. Because the reason you get black box models in the first place is that you're dealing with mathematical patterns that obtain across these massive troves of data. Well, and there are some tools to poke around to try to see inside the black box, but now massively increase exponentially the data that is going to be processed. It's going to be a lot harder to look inside that black box. So the black box problem is not, I don't think it's going to get better just because there are various technical tools to look inside the black box. I think that problem is going to get a lot worse. And we're going to have to really, really think, okay, why did this healthcare chatbot recommendation system recommend that this person start a treatment for preventing diabetes? Why does it think that this person has diabetes? Ugh. We don't know, but we know that it's making this prediction based on a tremendous amount of data. Do we trust it? And this issue of trusting black boxes, I think, is just going to become a bigger and bigger issue. And then there's various surveillance technology. We've already got facial recognition software. Once again, you combine, we're going to get more data. One of my big fears that I bring up frequently is facial recognition software is pretty scary. I find lip reading software scary when you're able to point a camera at somebody across the room and see their lips move, and the camera can read their lips and see what they're saying. So it's not just seeing what their face is, but you actually know what they're saying. That's terrifying. Then you combine that, of course, with facial recognition software. Now you know who it is and what they're saying. That's even worse. Or maybe you don't even need the facial recognition software. Maybe you just have the way that we move our mouths, the way that we move our tongues, the way that we move our jaws when we talk itself becomes a kind of fingerprint. And so now you can point the camera and identify both who it is and what they're saying. That terrifies me. Then you got quantum computers. They've got their ways of sensing things. There's quantum sensing, and then there's quantum computers, and there's various ways that quantum computers sense things. And that's also going to create surveillance problems. I don't know. Should I go on? There's a lot of problems.
Yeah, that was quite a list. I'm a little terrified now. But I think one of the things you talked about earlier about sort of this issue around sort of social media and the intersection of AI sort of got me thinking about your prior point on procurement, because it sounds like, I mean, what we're headed towards, given sort of the availability of very convincing AI, ChatGPT, whatever you might consider the system to be, we're talking about AI or AI tools or black model tools involved in not just sort of a final product or the data analysis team. It might be the HR team. It might be the marketing team procuring something off the shelf, which is using an AI model. And you can see sort of how everything a company might be buying, all of the SaaS products and tools might have some sort of component of risk. And if they're not set up to sort of evaluate the risks or the ethics of their existing product, they probably aren't set up to evaluate the risks of the products they're purchasing, the off-the-shelf products. It seems like we're heading towards a real exponential curve of risk consideration facing companies who want to do this and approach this.
Yeah, that's right. And let's pull these two things apart. There's sort of two sides to the procurement problem. One is just off-the-shelf products. They're AI-powered, or they're blockchain, or they're quantum-powered, or they're an AI quantum SaaS, whatever it is. You have to be able to do the proper vetting there. That's one issue. So are we using a product that is ethically objectionable, ethically, reputationally, regulatorily, or legally risky? And do we have the resources to vet that product? Do the people that are being sold to understand that, oh my God, this thing needs to be flagged and it needs to be reviewed internally by the appropriate experts, right? That's one bucket. The bad news is that's the easy bucket. The hard bucket is the one that we're seeing now, which is selling things like generative AI, right? So OpenAI creates ChatGPT-4, creates an API for enterprise developers to use. They're relatively opaque, not really, they're just opaque about how they designed ChatGPT-4, what the training data looks like, et cetera, et cetera. And then the developers receive it and they're supposed to do something with it. They're supposed to make it work for their particular organization by, for instance, training it on internal organizational data, right? We're going to use our data to train it, so it can answer our questions about our organization and our people and our clients because we've trained it on our data. But they're inheriting this model that is opaque to them. So how are they supposed to really know what risks they should look out for as they continue to fine-tune that foundational model, the generative AI that was sold to them? How are they supposed to know what risks to identify when they're fine-tuning it? And again, when I say what risks they're supposed to identify, I mean technical risks, that they're going to work well. I mean cybersecurity risks, so that they don't expose themselves to a cyber vulnerability, and ethical, reputational, and regulatory legal risks. How do they do that knowing that they don't know what's really going on with this model because the vendor is not going to share that information with them because it's part of their IP, they say? Huge problem. So that makes the standard procurement problem look like a cakewalk.
I just think that for the developers out there who are listening to this, I mean, I think from the scale of what a fine-tuned model could be, taking sort of your corporate data and sort of adding it on top of GPT-4 and building your own model, that sounds great. But in terms of the risk consideration, the core model for GPT-4, I mean, blew my mind. It's 100 trillion parameters put in there that it'd be sort of silly to think that, you know, most companies out there would be able to sort of fine-tune a model that would be really overtake or overcome those sort of ethical black box issues. That model is huge and comes with a lot of weight behind it. So understanding that is going to be pretty critical to their ethics understanding.
Yep.
Yeah, sorry guys, I was just checking Zillow for bunkers in my area. So
by now's the time.
Yeah. So yeah, we've always, as a kind of product leader, we've always kind of coached our teams to not only ask the question, can we, but should we? There's always that should we kind of branch in the decision tree that you need to prioritize as you're deciding where to invest and how to invest. But never has that been, I think, more important than today, based on our landscape, this discussion, and what lies ahead. So what I'm hearing, Reed and James, and you guys tell me if you disagree, but I'm hearing the absolute importance of an educated public, an educated industry, and a well-equipped policy landscape. And policy is essential, but we're not gonna survive this risk landscape on policy alone. We need to have educated and strong stewards of ethics, basically product design. We need to make sure that the development and the consumption of these solutions are done with a stronger understanding of the implications, not only of the utility of these technologies, but also the convergence of these technologies, Reed, to your point. So we need to go back upstream to almost the education, the prioritization and stewardship of investments within organizations. And then also policy needs to step upstream and understand how these technologies are being considered and designed, and get closer to the upstream decisions to understand what they need to do in order to establish frameworks for governance to protect the citizenry. So is that kind of solving world peace right there? And does that solve our problem?
I suppose it would solve our problem if we could do all that stuff. Look, one thing to say, of course, I think the question we can do about should we, that's a core paradigm ethical question. For most companies, they're not gonna ask that question. They're gonna ask themselves, look, given and in some cases, given the marketplace, we can predict that they will do it. So I don't think the question for most companies is, I mean, I want them to ask that question, and I'd love for them in an ideal world to say, I know that we can, but should we? And the answer is no, and then they don't. But hoping that most companies are going to answer that question, ask that question, answer it well, and then comply with their own answer, hoping that it happens at scale, I think is hopeless. The question that I think should loom large in their minds then is, given that we're going to do it, how can we do it in a way that mitigates the ethical harms or the ethical wrongs that we might give rise to? How do we avoid those things? It's a how question, not whether. How do we mitigate it? The other thing to say quickly is that I don't think educating the general citizenry is the go-to move. It's too complicated. And the comparison that I like to use is things like what credit card companies are and are not allowed to do as they try to sell me things. I don't know. I know that they're not allowed to commit fraud in various ways. I know that there are regulations around banks and credit card companies that say, look, you can't engage in these kinds of predatory practices. I don't even know what those predatory practices are. I just know that I'm protected from them because there are laws against that kind of thing. I don't think we want to ask every citizen to understand the rules and regulations that financial service companies are bound by. It's too much. We need the right people to be educated so that the right kinds of policies, regulations, et cetera, can be passed and upheld.
And to follow up on that, I mean, I think it sounds like if we can't maybe push from the regulatory side, at least from the sort of the corporate governance side, there's an opportunity here to sort of expand the thinking around AI ethics from a, okay, do my developers understand it, to, my procurement team needs to understand this. My procurement team needs to have a sort of a core level of digital or AI ethics literacy, as we talk about sort of financial literacy, AI ethics literacy, in order to just evaluate proposals and products on the market safely and effectively. I mean, that seems like at least now it seems bare minimum for corporate governance.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, and there are different ways of doing that. I mean, you could have a sort of centralized entity or group that does the kind of vetting. You might have it decentralized. So maybe your HR team already has someone on staff that's in the HR department that works on these kinds of issues, as opposed to kicking it off to the centralized team. So there's different ways different organizations can do this. But yeah, I agree with you that you got to do this kind of thing. Otherwise, you're just playing with fire. And to one of the earlier points, it enables a lot of companies to do what they want to do anyway. They want to use AI. They want to use these technologies. They want to innovate. That's great. Go do that stuff. Just don't do it in a reckless way.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're exactly right, man. So much here. And it really, once again, the speed at which these technologies are being developed and deployed is truly unlocking just tremendous economic and societal value, but also risk. So at this speed, understanding governance and policy are hard-pressed, clearly, to match pace, potentially setting the stage for harmful rather than beneficial outcomes for society. So designing for ecosystemic wellness, designing for not bad, requires a thorough assessment and an upstream assessment of the ethical implications of the likely experiences and outcomes these technologies and their convergences are intended to provide. James, your thought?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that that upstream acknowledgement that the ethical considerations facing organizations, companies, it's not just within their office, it's within their supply chain and their customer base, and all the perspectives upstream and downstream from them have to be part of their considerations. I think that's a really great takeaway for today.
Yeah, there's so much here that we could discuss, and we could probably keep you here for hours, Reid. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your insights, your perspective, your work, your worldview. Before we wrap, though, if there's one piece of advice that you'd share with our listeners to make sure we kind of synthesize this into some actionable takeaways for them, what would you advise?
Well, this might get a little bit into the weeds, but the mistake that I see that companies make that try to do this sort of thing is that they'll write these high-level ethics principles, and then they want to implement. And what I think is absolutely crucial for organizations to do is to perform a gap in feasibility analysis around implementing an AI ethical risk program. When companies don't do that, they run into massive obstacles, they run into walls, it stalls everything, and everything just seems to grind to a halt. So get a grip on what your standards are, what your ethical nightmares are, I think is the main thing. And then get a grip on how far are we away from being in a place where we're systematically avoiding those things. Then go develop your framework.
Great advice. Great advice. Reid, James, thanks so much for joining us here today. And for our audience, please join us for future episodes that explore the technological advances and structural patterns and that will help us better innovate, operate, and navigate in our increasingly connected world. And please subscribe and learn more at shoshaworks.com. Thanks, Reid and James. Great discussion.
Thanks so much.